Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 305. This is episode number 3, and we are going to be watching Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, Criterion's third release on Laserdisc. Surprisingly, this is the first release that has zero special features. No commentary, you can't even pause the movie. But they were excited to show off Hitchcock's film that made him famous. He had made a number of films in Britain before, but this was the first time that he became an international star, and this essentially allowed him to come to America and become the famous director that we know today. With me today, my guest is Catherine Dvorak, who
Hi.
Is a artist, an actress, a graphic designer, just an all-around wonderful person.
Well, thanks. You're a little bit biased, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
A little bit. I'll admit for journalistic integrity that we are engaged.
Yes.
But so, Catherine, what is your familiarity with this film?
So I've actually seen two productions of 39 Steps, aptly called 39 Steps when it was done by the Nebraska Repertory Theater. So University of Lincoln, Nebraska is where I went to school for acting, and their summer repertory chose this, I believe, for their 2010 season. And then I saw it most recently with my friend Lindsay and also Shannon. Lindsay's father was actually in a production out in one of the suburbs of Illinois.
When you say aptly named 39 Steps, did I hear that right?
Yes. So okay. The first production, well, and really Lindsay's father's production as well, leans on a lot of slapstick, a lot of comedy. It's very silly. And so the first production I saw at UNL, they had a lot of accents. They played with a lot of accents, and steps was commonly said instead of steps, and so everybody just called it 39 steps, and it just kind of stuck. So that's how I say it now.
Gotcha. All right, and what about your familiarity with Hitchcock? Have you seen any Hitchcock films before?
No, not all the way through, really. Mm. I still have a general understanding of, you know, the Hitchcock style. And also saw Hitchcock Tales, which is an improv group that performs pretty regularly at the Annoyance Theater, and naturally they pulled out a lot of tropes that Hitchcock is known for, and I feel I got the essence of Hitchcock. He did The Birds, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I did see that all the way through. Took me a bit to think if I actually saw the end, and I just remembered being extremely frustrated by it. So it's all coming back to me.
They don't solve anything, right? Nope, the birds just eat everybody.
Yeah, you never know why they were following her. And I honestly am one of those people where, like, I need to know the why.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm left with a huge cliffhanger, like, I don't know, what do you think happened? I can't stand it. It's so frustrating. I need to know.
What do you think are the odds that that will happen in 39 Steps?
Not good. I don't think it's good. I can't say I think that it's one of the tropes that he leaves, like, these huge cliffhangers at the end of his movies.
Yeah.
But I could see that being a thing. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we will find out. We'll compare this version to both the book that it's based on and the parody play that came well after it. And we'll let you know what we think. Feel free to take this break to watch the film, and we will be right back.
The English lady, where is she?
There has been no English lady here.
I'm not!
Next episode, it's Alfred Hitchcock's 1938 thriller classic, The Lady Vanishes. Welcome back, everybody. We have finished watching The 39 Steps roughly 24 hours ago. We decided to take a little break and think about the movie for a while before discussing again. Hopefully you all enjoyed it as much as we did. I will start off by asking Catherine, what do you think, sort of in broad strokes, overall of the film?
In broad strokes, with my past experience with 39 Steps, I was actually quite surprised how similar the movie is to the scripts, and or at least the scripts are very much like the movie. Overall, it was really satisfying to see, like, the humor that I know from the play being pulled out in the movie. Like, really, they didn't have to try too hard to make the play funny because the humor was already there. So maybe also just in my context, some of the moments seemed silly, whereas back then they probably wouldn't have been deemed maybe as silly. But overall, I thought the cast did a really great job. There was some really neat direction, and overall, it's a really fast-paced movie. So much that happens to that poor guy. He has just such a rough time throughout the entirety of the film. But it was fun.
What's an example of something that you thought was funny that may not have been?
Let's see. I think maybe the moments where he's kind of dragging her about when they're handcuffed together. And the humor of him getting, like, kind of tangled up in the fence. I don't know. That was pretty clearly funny. Yeah. He just, like, rammed her head into the fence. He had no, like, care whatsoever how she was gonna get around the fence until it became a real problem.
I wonder if that was an outtake that they just left in the movie.
Yeah, I thought it was so brilliant. Yeah. Well, if it was an outtake, I thought the actress did a lovely job. It really convinced me that she was just totally out of it and could not
dead
be
weight.
Helped. Yeah, just totally dead weight. She wasn't gonna help him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. To recap, just in case you skipped watching the movie at home, we've got an extremely early example of a, like, suspense chase movie, at least as far as sound pictures go. And it was definitely both, like, a comedy and a drama, strong elements of both. And we've got a man named Richard...
Hannay.
Who we know absolutely nothing about. He seems to be a traveler in Britain, presumably from Canada, based on some early comments. He is in a theater when some gunshots ring out.
It's a classic case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. Pretty much the whole movie is just scene after scene of that. And so he meets a mysterious woman. She tells him about a terrible plot to smuggle secrets out of the country. She's killed. He has to go on the run. Everybody's after him. And eventually he runs into another woman who begrudgingly becomes his crewmate on this adventure.
Begrudgingly meaning, like, literally through the second half of the film, like, handcuffed to him and dragged about.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's got to sort out his innocence in this matter of the killing of the woman, and also stop the secret from getting out of the country. It seemed definitely a lot of slapstick sort of moments.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I think the very first one that stands out is when the first woman is introduced. She comes out of the bedroom, and is carrying a very important letter for Hannay, and is just straight up stabbed in the back and falls straight onto his lap, which always stood out to me as a very rememberable moment from the play, because whenever you see the actresses do it, they plank on the armchairs, armrests. And so the first production I saw, at least, like, the actor who played Hannay had to slither out from underneath this woman who was just planking on the armchair in his lap, with a knife just sticking out of her back. So one of the more humorous moments of the play. And they lean into it in the movie.
She had a very, I thought, overly dramatic death.
Oh, yeah.
Of croaking the last words out and then, like...
Yeah. And that was when I first realized that this actually may be a comedy. I thought it was going to be so much more serious and much more of a thriller. But that I laughed. I wasn't sure if that was purposeful, but it was just pretty silly.
I thought I remembered after the movie that there was a great subtle line at the beginning that foreshadowed the tone of the movie, which was after he leaves with the German woman from the theater. She out of the blue asks him, "Can I come home with you?"
Yeah, just totally out of the blue.
Right.
Just.
He's taken aback by that, and he, you know, he asks to make sure, and she says, "Yes, I'm just, you know, terribly upset, and I would feel safer coming home with you."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Well, it's your funeral," and then they walk off.
Yeah.
And I didn't think about it at the time that he said it, because I didn't know what was coming, but then remembering back, it's like, oh, no, it literally was her funeral.
Oh, God.
Which I thought was pretty indicative of, like, the dark comedy element of this that Hitchcock played up.
No, you're totally right. For some reason, it just kind of made me think of a couple of unfortunate, like, cases with serial murderers and the victim asking, it's like, well, you aren't a serial murderer, are you?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, calling it out, but instead he kind of called it out. It was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, it did end up being her funeral. Oh, sucks to suck. Case of the Mondays, huh?
Reading about the book that this was based on, it seems like, even though the plot apparently is, there's a lot of significant differences from the book was also kind of a outlandish caper, where there was like a quote from the author saying that he intentionally, he thought of this book as a shocker, was his description of the genre.
No, he didn't describe it as an outlandish caper, because that's pretty fun.
Those are my words.
That's okay. good choice of words.
Thanks. But he said that he wanted, like, everything that happened to this character to be right on the edge of possibility.
Huh.
So it was, like, riding up to the line of people saying, well, that's just ridiculous. That would never happen.
Well, that reminds me when he's trying to escape his apartment after the woman slash, like, double agent or spy or whatever had just been murdered. He tries to escape, but sees the two men in trench coats outside who she had pointed out earlier. And so this milkman, or whoever, arrives, who's wearing a pretty distinguishable coat. And he's like, hey, can I borrow your coat? And he's like, well, why? Needs to be a good reason. And he's like, yeah, there's these two spies out there. There's a woman dead in my apartment. They're after me now. And it's just, oh, it sucks. And I need a disguise to get out of here. And the milkman is like, you're yanking my chain. That's ridiculous. No, you aren't getting my coat. And then he changes his story immediately to say that he was just sleeping with a married woman, and needed to get out without her husband finding out. And he's like, oh, well, why didn't you say so? And just, like, handed over his coat for, I think, very little cash.
I don't think he gave him any cash.
Oh.
He said, it's on me. You would do the same for me.
Oh, that's
if I were
right.
In this position.
It was a charitable act.
Yeah.
Because he was actually rather proud of him. And
he's
like, oh, good chum. Now that I know you got laid, here's a free jacket. Have a great day.
Mm-hmm. There's also, I made a note of later on when he is, so he gets shot. He meets the actual bad guy who's missing the part of his pinky.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a great twist where the bad guy pulls out a gun. You're not sure exactly what's going to happen, if he's going to try and, like, kidnap him or whatever. And then, blam, gun goes off, Hannah goes down. It's only the middle of the movie. And it's like, whoa. Okay, what happens now?
Uh-huh.
And then they cut back to an earlier couple that we had seen in a farmhouse who the wife had lent our main character her husband's coat.
Yeah, like over a case of like 6 hours, she gets Stockholm Syndrome and like wants to do everything in her power to help him.
We find out like from their conversation about the coat being missing that there was a Bible in the coat.
Yeah,
that
one
stopped
hell of a
Bible. The bullet. That's like, I mean, obviously that's silly on its own and very common. You know, we've both seen tons of stories where that happens. That a Bible or something in the pocket stops a bullet. But it made me wonder if this was the first instance of that happening. Like, if this is where the cliche came from.
Huh.
I couldn't find any confirmation. I looked on, there's a website called TV Tropes that lets you, like, look into this kind of stuff. And
oh,
it had tons
smart.
Of examples, but they weren't chronological.
Oh.
So I don't know.
Dang it.
If this invented it.
That's too bad. Yeah, I immediately thought of the Stranger Than Fiction version, where, like, a bit of his watch that he's so obsessed with inevitably,
mm-hmm.
like, lodges in one of his arteries after a terrible, like, accident. I want to
mm-hmm.
be careful not to ruin too many movies for you all here. But inevitably, his life is saved by, like, an object on his person. I guess I still spoiled that movie for you all.
yes.
Oops, sorry about it.
Just wait a year. You won't remember.
Yeah.
So what do you think, was there a moment in the movie that you thought was the funniest?
Oh, that is a good question. I don't know. They all kind of made me chuckle.
Mm-hmm.
I had a really hard time kind of separating those funny moments to the bits that I remember from the play.
Mm-hmm.
So at the very beginning, when the first woman, I can say, I'll just number the women because there's only three of them throughout the entire movie, but in the play,
right.
they're all played by the same actress.
Oh.
So the first woman, when she reveals this whole plot to Hene, mentions that there are two men in trench coats standing out by lamppost in a way to, like, kind of prove that she's right and she's not
mm-hmm.
lying to him. And sure enough, there's these two people who are standing by the lamppost. So in the play, they pull out this very, like, cheaply made kind of cardboard 2D lamp post looking thing,
mm-hmm.
and then they disappear, but then the actress mentions them again and they have to haul ass back out on the stage real quick. It's very slapshick. They're kind of like nudging each other along. Looks like something straight out of Warner Brothers. There's that, and like the chase scenes that I thought were always particularly well done. So this dude is constantly running away
mm-hmm.
from these two trench-coated men throughout the entire movie. And in some of those Catch Me If You Can montages, Hene is running throughout the train.
Mm-hmm.
Through the length of the train, he's going in and out of compartments, going outside of the train. And so I saw this really clever use of props as set, like they were using suitcases as series of blocks, and the actors were like
mm-hmm.
jumping to and from these blocks. And
this is all in the play version?
Yeah, this
okay.
is all in the play version. And it would be these like several minute long, like really well choreographed blocks of them miming, climbing on the train and being very delicate and climbing up of these small boxes that were made to look like suitcases. And so it just ended up being a really brilliant chase scene. So all of the funny moments that made up the play for me came out of the character actors or the people who were playing multiple parts throughout the show.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I was seeing a little bit of that humor throughout the movie, not as much, but near the end of one of the major chase scenes when he is running away and she flaps into the fence
mm-hmm.
and is basically dead weight before she suddenly snaps to and starts screaming again,
mm-hmm.
which is an odd choice. get back to that later. But I thought that was still a hilarious moment. The comedy between them being handcuffed and him supposedly trying to be a gentleman about it, but mm-hmm. clearly also touching her in the moment. So that humor at least was played up, which I was happy to see, because it is like a ridiculous moment, mm-hmm. And a rather, frankly, like unfortunate position for her to be in. So yeah. As a woman watching that, I'm like, this is not cool.
Well, and they're handcuffed for like 20 minutes of the film, it seemed like.
Yeah, they're handcuffed for quite some time before he passes out and she manages to squeeze her little wrist out of it.
That looks so painful.
It did. It really did. It did not look like they were loosening the handcuffs for that poor actress who had to pull her wrist out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That.
I hope she was double jointed.
My funniest moment was the political rally that he accidentally finds himself in.
Oh, yes. He's actually pretty eloquent through the whole thing as he's watching the whole thing go down behind the audience.
Mm-hmm.
So he watches the female character number two,
mm-hmm.
Who was like forcibly kissed by him in one of the earlier scenes, and she's slowly but surely telling the cops and everybody at
mm-hmm.
the event that he's not who they think he is.
But yeah, the rally speech that he gives for a candidate that he knows absolutely nothing about, that just sort of came out of nowhere for me, and they did, like you mentioned, such a great job of like slowly setting up all of these characters on the perimeter, who are staging their arrest of this guy as he's just stalling and stalling and trying to figure out on the spot.
Yeah.
And there's a great visual gag of him attempting to announce the name of the candidate, realizing he doesn't know what it is, looking down at the table in front of him and seeing it upside down, and it's like 20 letters long.
Yeah, it's a very complicated name.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And he ends up... he reads it like about as well as you could, which is McCrocodile.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Which gets a good laugh. Aside from that, something that I noticed overall
mm-hmm.
for the film was that, so kind of like the Bible in the breast pocket,
mm-hmm.
I felt like I could see, since this was so early, 1935,
mm-hmm.
that I read that this was actually the first British sound film.
No shit.
Yeah.
Really?
I'm sorry. Not this one. Hitchcock's earlier film, Blackmail, 1929. Hitchcock got to make the first British sound film. So this is a few years later, but I just thought that was noteworthy that he was, like, Hitchcock's role in film history was that prominent.
Jesus.
So
now I wonder what other ones they did in between that and 39
Steps. There were a few. He did, so just before this one, I think he did The Man Who Knew Too Much, which was another thriller.
Hmm.
With Peter Lorre, who's that? Do you know him?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, he's in a lot of the film noir movies as the henchman. He's like a really little guy, and he's got kind of big eyes, and he talks kind of like this.
Oh yes, okay.
Yeah,
yep, that's
he's
all
in all
I
the
needed.
Cartoons.
Yep,
yeah,
absolutely. Almost a character of himself. See, that's the kind of movie that I was expecting.
Sure.
This to
more
be
of a film
naturally.
Noir.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so something I was considering watching this movie was that not only did I recognize a lot of things from Hitchcock's later movies that
mm-hmm.
he brought back in various ways, but also I could see, with this being from 1935, how much it seemed to have influenced just movies in general in this genre. And there were a lot of really specific things where I was like, oh, I've seen that before in other movies, and I've seen that.
Were you talking about, like, filming tricks? Because I know the one that you pointed out when they were
in the
kidnapped,
car.
Basically, or yeah. They were being taken to another secret location. There was this really neat shot that you were impressed by. Was that one that you were talking about, or...?
Not specifically.
Okay.
Although that was... I'll just mention that that was a really surprising shot to me, that they had shown the backseat of the car with the two main characters as they're being driven away by the bad guys. And it's clearly, a studio set, and they've got a projector of the background going by. But then the camera backs up and around the rear of the vehicle, and in one fluid-looking shot, the camera is suddenly outside of the vehicle as it's driving away into the distance.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to rewind and watch it again to see how they had pulled that off, and they had just very cleverly hidden the cut between two shots as it passed by this black section of the hood.
Mm-hmm.
Or not the hood, but the roof.
Yeah, yeah. Where the back window met the side window.
And it did remind me of Children of Men.
Hmm.
Have you seen that one?
No.
There's this great... So, there's a number of very long takes in that movie where the camera just goes all over the place. And it also uses the same kind of tricks to, like, hide the edits to make it look even longer than it was.
Cool.
And there is particularly one, like, I don't know, 5-minute sequence of the main characters in a car where the camera was looking back and forth between all the characters as they're just goofing around and having a moment of, like, fun in the middle of this catastrophe.
Hmm.
And then something terrible happens to them in the car, and the camera pulls out of it and goes onto the road.
Whoa.
And then you keep watching it. It's like, how on earth did they do that? But
like, it looks like the camera zooms through the glass of
yeah,
the car window.
Something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
And they basically they had like a cool, they had a rig that sat on top of the car with the roof cut open so the camera could hang inside and swivel around and look at all the people.
Neat.
And then they just found like a place to cheat the edit between two shots to put it outside.
Hmm.
But what I was thinking of in particular was like a lot of plot elements or devices that I recognize.
Hmm.
So, and almost all of them had to do with James Bond. Because to me, that was like the closest analog I could think of to this storyline, was this really feels like Sean Connery or Roger Moore as James Bond.
Shit, you're so right. It just is missing a couple of explosions and like...
Yeah.
Some sort of combination of an animal and like terrible weapon, and you got a Bond movie.
Sharks with lasers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And the first time I noticed it was when Hannah is in the train.
Uh-huh.
And the cops are on the train as well.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get away from them. He's going from room to room trying to figure out where he can hide.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he finds the woman Pamela and barges in and sits down and kisses her.
Yeah, that's like his first move. Is
yeah.
Just barges in and kisses her.
It's perfect cover.
Yeah.
They never, of course, they find him immediately.
Works every time, right?
Yeah.
2% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time.
I didn't look up to confirm, but I'm almost positive that's in at least one, if not two, Bond movies. And I want to say it was from Russia with Love, because I know a lot of that is on a train.
Mm.
And there's a similar sort of, like, him running into a woman and seducing her to get away,
mm-hmm.
if I remember correctly. And then also, I feel like there is another gag like that in GoldenEye, when the Russian computer programmer woman, Natalia, is on the bad guy's train, and I think I remember something similar happening of the bad guy barging, or the good guy barging in.
Real quick, do you remember how those women responded? Because Pamela, right?
Yeah.
Pamela was having none of it. He,
yeah.
like, tried to... apologize and say, I'm sorry, just all this bullshit is going on. And he was straight up with her
mm-hmm.
from the very beginning. But she was like, uh-uh. And the moment that the authorities came back, she was like, this guy right here, not supposed to be here.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciated that. She didn't immediately go, well, okay, maybe I'll stick around and see what happens, you know?
Yeah.
I appreciated that she wasn't having any of it and was
willing
to give him up.
I mean, if I'm not making all of this up, I think that in From Russia with Love, she does fall for him. And then in GoldenEye, she does not.
Okay. I was going to ask for the first one, like, how long it was after that scene until she ended up falling for him or ended up seeing his ways, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the very least, you know, definitely that's, like, a long-running thing with Bond is he's just so smooth, even when he's, you know, roughing women up, that inevitably they're going to fall for him. And they've got tons of witty banter between him and the Bond women always,
which
we see again here.
Yeah, still manages to find time to be totally smooth and collected,
mm-hmm.
have some witty banter, because, you know, a lot of the women, although they end up being purely there for looks and sex, are usually pretty intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
I say having not seen all of the Bond films.
With a few notable exceptions.
Okay, great. I was gonna say, it's like some of them seem to have a pretty smart head on their shoulders.
Some of them.
Yeah. I forgot what point I was making with that. Drat. Oh, it's totally going somewhere. Anyways.
Well,
let's rewind, listen back what I was saying before that all happened.
The next one I noticed was when Hene hides in the parade that's going by.
Yeah.
It's
pretty convenient that a parade should pop up in the middle of that chase.
Yep. And there was that happened in one of the Roger Moore films when Jaws is the villain. There's like a Mardi Gras parade that he uses to his advantage to get away from the bad guy.
Mm.
And then I think maybe it was a more recent one. I know there was another movie I saw recently where the good guy, he gets shot, and it's during a parade that's happening, and the villain is chasing him through the parade, and he ends up, like, hiding on a parade float.
Is that dude, like, shot in the middle of the parade? Does anybody notice, or is this,
no,
like,
because it's too chaotic.
Okay.
And then, aside from just in general how Hene interacts with Pamela, seems very
mm-hmm.
Bondian. There was, oh, aside from the influence on spy movies and thrillers and Bond in general, I noticed that in the theater at the end of the movie, they have that shot where I think Pamela's looking through the opera glasses. One of them is, anyway, around the theater looking for the bad guys.
Oh,
remember
I think
that?
That's actually Hene. I think, like, he borrows some from, like, somebody in the audience next to him, and then she ends up joining him, but he's looking through the glasses.
And he sees the killer in the box office seat.
Yeah, looking totally mischievous.
Yeah, and I had to look it up, but there was, I remember, a very similar scene in a movie 20 years later that Hitchcock made called The Man Who Knew Too Much, which was a remake of his own earlier film, The Man Who Knew Too Much, with Peter Lorre, that I mentioned.
Huh.
But this time it was completely different plot with, so just same title, and it had Jimmy Stewart, where it was like a couple is on vacation in Morocco or something like that, and they get wrapped up in this international plot to assassinate somebody.
Hate to see that happen.
The bad guys kidnap their son.
No.
And the movie's about the couple chasing after the bad guys on their own. And it ends, there's a late scene in the movie with they're in this theater in England and the bad guys are there and the play is going on and they're looking around through some binoculars or apple glasses and spotting them up in the box seat. And
why
so
is the
on.
Bad guy at the theater? So they stole their husband?
I don't remember, but somehow they somehow all of them ended up at the theater. I think the bad guys were at this point chasing after the couple.
Wow, theater. Good place for a showdown, apparently.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Did you notice that so this movie, 39 Steps, both begins and ends in a theater?
Yeah, it's actually also the same show that they end up coming in on.
Right, Mr. Memory.
Mr. Memory. Dr. Memory. Ah, yes.
I think.
I think it's Mr. Memory.
He's still working on his doctorate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he already knows everything. He doesn't need to, like, waste the time getting his doctorate. He's fine.
Mm-hmm. I hope so, since he did die after all.
Yeah.
Probably won't have another chance.
Well, he knows everything, so he probably knows it's just a scam. He's spending more money getting his doctorate.
Let's see, plot-wise, I didn't have any other particular notes other than, like, I think, you know, I was trying to think of, like, what Hitchcock's signature themes are.
Men who know too much, or people who know too much. That was one that I was thinking of a little bit ago when you were talking about that other movie that he had made.
Yeah.
But then I almost already argued to counter that by thinking of The Birds, where it's like, nobody knows what's happening.
Right.
Nobody knows too much, except for maybe the woman, but like, we don't know what she knows, and we don't even think she knows. I don't know. I don't even know.
Very true.
So I would be interested to see what the Hitchcock Tales group, which for everybody else who's listening, is an improv group in Chicago that actually performs once a week and does an improvised Hitchcock show, and everybody is drinking the whole time, and they basically rely
including the actors?
Yes, including the actors, especially the actors. But naturally, to, you know, improvise all of these Hitchcock shows, they've had to do a significant amount of research and watch a lot of his movies, so I'd be interested to see what kind of tropes they've picked up on.
He's got over 50 movies.
Yeah, exactly. I don't got time to catch up with that. Like, I'll have more educational talkbacks with people who've watched all those movies for me. And watch the ones that stand out. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's smart.
Thank you.
Very effective.
I think so. There's a lot to see out there.
Using other people to get ahead.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a lot of actors and people in Hollywood.
Yeah. I think for me, but, like, my guess about his sort of recurring theme was the idea of ordinary people finding themselves in extraordinary situations. And I haven't seen many of his movies either, but that seemed to at least fit with the ones that I've seen. That it's the main characters are, they're just normal people. We usually don't know much about them, and they're suddenly thrust into this bizarre either horror or thriller or chase or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's like things escalate very quickly and become
And I like Vertigo, I think that was the case. It's, you know, it's just somebody happens across a mysterious woman or you know, a bad omen like a bird or stops in the wrong hotel or whatever it is.
That's the worst one of all.
Yeah. And well, like in this movie 39 Steps, something I didn't bring up but that did make me also think of James Bond was that we know absolutely nothing about the main character.
Right.
He's
don't
got a
know
mustache.
Anything.
That's about it.
Yeah. Throughout the play, when they're doing the news clip bits and saying like what the newspapers are saying about the case and the murder and
of the
telling
German
people
woman, right?
to yes yeah. and they're telling people to keep the lookout for Hene, and they give a description which includes his like pencil mustache, and it also, like, every review or article that they read says that he's dashingly handsome and extremely charming. And so I think that kind of, like, highlights the little bit that you actually know of this guy, other than he's just unfortunately caught up in this whole big mess through no fault of his own, barely any fault of his own, at least. Seems like he was practically chosen. She went right up.
He was just trying to be nice.
Yeah, he was just trying to be nice. In a odd, like, almost too welcoming sort of way. I mean, he made a bad joke, like, it's your funeral.
Yeah.
Nowadays, if somebody made a joke like that and you're going home with a stranger, you'd be like, nope, hard pass. Like, that's it. Can't even joke about that.
Well, and then when they do get back to his place, you, even in his own home, you can't glean any more information.
All his stuff is covered, so it looks like he just moved in. But I mentioned this in the start of the film. Everything else looks like it's, not lived in, but the liquor cabinet, fully stocked. Like, he had all of the rocks, glasses, all sort of, liquors and mixers you could possibly want.
Because he knows what's important.
He knows what's important. Priorities, man. Something that I got a kick out of when they first walk into his apartment, other than everything being covered in sheets. The first thing that this woman does is slowly walk all the way across the room in the dark and presses herself up against the wall, becomes one with it, and then, like, after a 10-second pause of not even looking to scan the room, but just standing there, pressing up against the wall, looking to the side, says, okay, now you can turn the lights on. Like, I wasn't sure if she was trying to clear the room or that was her just dramatic entry and that's how she was just feeling all of the feelings that she was going through. But that, I felt, was very similar to, like, the King Kong moment where the ladder is 1 foot away from the woman and she doesn't use it. It's just like, oh, you're trying to be a spy and yet you're, like, the worst spy ever and don't know how to scan a frickin' room. That got me.
But how do you really feel?
Flames from the side of my face. Yeah.
Well, so as an actress, what did you think of the performances? Maybe aside from the German woman.
I have a difficult time looking at, like, the acting and the style and techniques that were used back then for film and what I would consider to be good acting now. And granted, like, the whole play and the story is a little bit elevated, and so there's a lot of caricatures. Overall, I would say everybody did a very good job. Hene and Pamela, the actors, those two characters did a great job. The villain was a good villain. It's hard to tell, but it looked like a evil silver fox, which is perfect and I think fits the James Bond theme.
And he wasn't even disfigured.
Disfigured. Yeah, he was missing part of his pinky. I thought the reveal was hilarious. So when we find out that Hene is actually talking to the villain that he was warned about, it's a classic moment where Hene is describing exactly how you can identify the villain and goes, oh, I think he's missing part of his finger. Yes, this one. And then the villain holds up his hand and goes, you mean this one? And you can clearly see that his pinky is, like, lobbed off. So that was a good reveal moment. So the first production I saw of 39 Steps at the Nebraska Repertory just had, like, a phenomenal cast. Melissa Lewis, Robbie Hayek, and... Ryan Kathman, and then I believe the fourth one was an Equity actor who they had come from out of state. But they just really leaned into the accents. Robbie Hayek specifically had a lot of clowning experience. And had already gone to like school for that, and so the physicality and the blocking throughout was just really well timed, and it's one of the most memorable performances that I've ever seen. And so I'd say in that sense, when the movie was shot, they did a great job for what was expected out of film actors. Is it the style that I like now? I wouldn't say so, but I love comedy. I love slapstick. I love that physical humor when people use props in weird and unique ways. And so this play really has a lot of opportunities for that. We were talking about it yesterday, where this play or this movie, it moves so fast. There's so many scene changes, and you know, he's being chased throughout, you know, several different countries, and so you really have to keep up with that in very unique and interesting ways. And so the play, in its like clever use of, you know, props and blocking, just has to tell that whole story. And when done well, it can be really effective and just even more hilarious.
Do you? I think I know the answer. Then, do you like the play better than the movie?
Yes.
You're hesitating more than I thought.
I would see another play of 39 Steps, like another production of it, before I would watch the movie again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Because also it's like every production is going to have its own interpretation. You know, everything's going to be different. The direction, the production, like, you know, the actors, the movie's always going to stay the same. But I do appreciate the movie and felt that it really gave a great framework for the play. I mean, it's practically the same thing. I was very surprised by that. But I would say, yeah, I liked the production more than the movie.
Then that leads me to my last question, which is, do you think it makes sense that this movie is part of the Criterion Collection? Especially such an early one. It's only number 3.
Yeah, it is. I wish that I had more experience with movies that were created at this time, like to have more things to compare it to. But honestly, I still feel that the movie was well done throughout. Directions, the unique shots that they were able to get, and overall the pacing of the movie I thought was really strong. So I would say yes, it deserves a spot in the Criterion Collection.
I would agree, if nothing else, from you know, what I read about the movie being the thing that made Hitchcock famous outside of Britain. Even if, you know, it's not as well remembered as some of his later works, I think that alone is probably worth the time of the, you know, the person interested in film history.
Yeah. I want to see how this was compared to, like, next to The Birds and Psycho?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's him.
I would want to see, like, where this would line up in terms of audience reviews and just general response.
It was quite popular from what I read when it came out. Yeah, the critics liked it. The audiences liked it. Made plenty of money. Didn't, I mean, it was British, so it didn't get a ton of like American awards or anything.
Oh, yeah, foreign film. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, so it at least helped catch the attention of David O. Selznick, who was a famous Hollywood producer. And we actually talked about him in both previous episodes, I think, because of how influential that guy was. He was most famous for Gone with the Wind. He produced Gone with the Wind.
So what did he have to do with the last two movies?
So, what was it? Well, he was responsible for Marion C. Cooper, who was the director of King Kong, getting into the film business because, or at least like kind of getting his early start because Cooper was an executive assistant for David O. Selznick. So like an intern, basically.
Okay.
A paid one. And and then...
Oh, they had paid ones back then?
Yeah.
That's nice. That's cute.
It's escaping me what... Oh. How he worked with Citizen Kane. I forgot what it was other than... He must have done something with Orson Welles that helped. It might have been that he encouraged Orson Welles to come to Hollywood from his theater and radio days.
So pretty influential.
Yeah. Well, and in this, the reason I brought him up was that he was the one who brought Hitchcock to Hollywood.
Yeah.
That he convinced him, like, hey, you're doing really great stuff over there. I want to see what you can do here. Come on out. And so Hitchcock and his wife, who apparently was a really close collaborator on many of his movies.
That's neat. I had heard
both
that.
Both came out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were they married their whole lives, or was he ever remarried?
From birth, yeah. I don't believe
I just remarried. Read a lot of Hollywood stories of, like, people, you know, like Joan Crawford, who had four marriages.
No, from what I saw, they were at least together for a very long time.
Okay.
Good
for that.
Yeah, she edited one of his earlier movies. She was the continuity supervisor on 39 Steps. She co-wrote several of his later movies.
That's neat. I appreciate that. Was she ever credited as such?
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yep. Yeah. He definitely credited her in various interviews and talked about how important she was to just him as a person and his career.
That's sweet. Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah. It made me think that there was probably something of their relationship in the very, like, witty relationship we saw in 39 Steps.
In the relationship between Hannay and Pamela?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Well, now I'm wondering what her thoughts are on behind the treatment of the main actress in The Birds. Because I had heard that, you know, it was just, like, an awful situation for her. Like, she was actually...
Oh, Tippi Hedren, the lead actress?
Yeah. They...
I don't know.
I know we're not talking about that movie, but, like, just to get a little bit into it for anybody who hasn't heard it before, apparently at the scene where there's even more birds directly attacking her to get the reality and the intensity of the moment, they actually threw real and very angry birds at the actress.
Yeah.
So a lot of the cuts and the things that she got from that were real. But also I heard that it, like, went on for an exuberant amount of time, like an unnecessary amount of time. It was like, Shelley Duvall was also, like, tormented in Shining.
Yeah.
In a different scene. I know that that wasn't Hitchcock, but it's just another instance of directors just kind of, like, abusing their actors for the shot and the scene that they want. And but again, that's a totally different movie, so we'll save it for whenever The Birds comes up in a conversation again.
Yeah, that one actually is not part of the Criterion Collection.
I didn't think so. I would have figured you'd mention it, considering we knew that this one and the next one are Hitchcock.
Well, speaking of which, that is the topic of our next episode. I'll go ahead and close it down here. We'll be doing episode 4, The Lady Vanishes, also by Alfred Hitchcock. And I would like to say thank you to Catherine Dvorak.
Thanks for having me.
Being here. Do you want to tell people your social media handles so you can get some exposure?
Oh, well, that's neat. Thanks. Yes, so I am an actor and artist here in Chicago. And so if you'd like to follow my Instagram, it's Catherine Does Art. Catherine spelled the right way. So Catherine Does Art. And my Facebook page is Catherine M. Dvorak. So I can follow those to get updates on what I'm doing theatrically and artistically. Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it. This was a fun movie to watch.
Likewise, and thank you to the audience. See you next time.